Thank you for tuning in to episode 115 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. You can join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. Listen to us every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on PRN.FM or download us after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast programs. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. If you'd like to sponsor this show, please contact me. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want the show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information you are gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges to others. If you would like me to speak at a meeting of an organization that you're a member of on science, medicine, viruses, democracy, or other social issues, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. This week, I'm going to talk with Charles Artel about the Clinton Foundation. He's an investor who's done a lot of research into the financial aspects of this foundation, and that's critically important because he calls it a giant financial scam. My co-host on the podcast, How Positive Are You?, first reached out to Artel and interviewed him for our podcast, focusing on the HIV/AIDS mission of the foundation. And through her, I was also able to arrange an interview. So thank you, Elizabeth. Charles Artel is an investor with a BA from Yale and an MBA from Harvard Business School who believes that the Clinton Foundation is, quote, the largest unprosecuted charity fraud ever attempted. He's the managing director of Newport Value Partners, which provides independent investment research to professional investors. He's written for The Washington Times, Breitbart, and other media outlets. He's well known to people in financial circles, at least, because in 2007, he became a whistleblower and exposed that General Electric was fraudulently overvaluing its stock by hundreds of billions of dollars. Welcome to the show, Charles.
It's an honor to be on, David. Thanks for reaching out to me.
Yeah, so I'd just like to ask you about the original purpose of the Clinton Foundation, as opposed to what is currently stated activities are, and why the difference between those two things is a problem.
Okay. So I wasn't familiar with this when I started on it in February of 2015. But my background, even though I have been on the board, I'm currently on the board of charities, I didn't really know the particular rule. So most business people, when they form corporations, they form them and they define their purposes as being basically anything you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay for a for-profit entity. But in the not-for-profit world, that's strictly forbidden if what it is you want is a tax exemption. The rules are very strict, and you may only get the valuable federal tax exemption, that is the right to offer your donors the chance to deduct a portion of their deduction against their current income, and the right as well to accumulate profits if you have profits, i.e. revenues greater than expenses each year. You accumulate those tax-free in a not-for-profit corporation. You can only get that right the way the rationale, as I understand it, for the statute is if you're relieving the burden of government. In other words, if your volunteers, you know, work more cheaply than the government might work,
right,
and if your entity is actually serving exclusively the public interest.
Mm-hmm.
You stand in the shoes of government as a not-for-profit corporation with your federal tax exemption. And the interesting thing is down in about in our country here in America is that there are over 1 million such charities, a lot. And by some estimates, the not-for-profit sector of the American economy is a seventh the size of our gigantic economy. So you're talking about a not-for-profit sector that is bigger than, you know, probably most countries in the world, bar maybe 5 or 10.
And there's a difference between different non-profits. Like, I'm involved with some non-profits that are not 501c3, and they have a business
right.
purpose, and they don't pay taxes, but I don't think they can accept donations.
Right.
They don't have
right.
all the other privileges. But the Clinton Foundation is a 501c3, is that correct?
Its main thing is a 501c3, it is, yes.
And so that means that gives them the right to give out tax donations to any, at least any American who donates to them, plus...
Not so fast.
Yeah,
not
no.
Not so fast.
No.
Not so fast. The way it works in America is that you get first a federal tax exemption, but in order to offer a state tax exemption in the states that have income taxes, you must register in each state, and you must file annual reports in each state, and those filings must be true and accurate in all material respects.
All right.
So it's not as simple as you get the federal tax exemption, that automatically gives you the state one.
So
then, in order to get one in Canada, if you have a Canadian donor giving to the Clinton Foundation, there are rules in Canada and in most other foreign countries.
Right, right. So presumably the Clinton Foundation was founded in Arkansas, which is where the Clintons are from. And
it is.
And it presumably had tax-free status in Arkansas. What about the other 49 states?
Well, it was illegally constituted, in my view, in Arkansas. And it has been illegally organized and operated everywhere that it's been.
Why do you say illegal?
Because a charity states what its purposes are. The purposes of the Clinton Foundation, the approved purposes. Mark Tapscott of the Daily Caller has a great piece out yesterday that recites this in some detail. But when you check the actual filings, you could go on the Clinton Foundation website, see this for yourself, confirm it for yourself. It was set up to be exclusively a library, a presidential archive, pursuant to a specific federal statute dealing with presidential archives that explains that such archives are not living memorials to former President Clinton and anything he chooses to do anytime he wakes up in the morning. No.
Right.
A presidential archive is an archive that studies what he did when he was president.
So for those Eight years.
So it's to do that and a related research facility, and that's it. And it's very clear in those filings that it was not authorized to pursue international activities. Because if you want to pursue international activities, on the forms you have to state that, and you have to explain what those are. And they never have filed to pursue international activities or any purpose other than being a presidential archive and a research facility in Little Rock.
But I think, you know, if the Clinton Foundation has been involved in Haiti, HIV/AIDS in Africa, climate change, I think if people felt that the Clinton Foundation was doing a lot of good, they'd probably forgive what to most people would just seem like some paperwork issues.
And I actually, I don't know how much you know about Larry David, the comedian, but he has a great way of saying it. Not so fast.
Not so fast. Okay. So set me straight.
Okay. So, you know, if the IRS were to take the position that, you know, getting one of these tax exemptions is just like a driver's license, you know, that you fill out the paperwork, you don't tell the IRS what kind of car, you know, what kind of foundation you're actually going to do, you just get approval to solicit donations tax-free, and then you do whatever the hell you feel like doing.
Right.
And there would be no need to regulate them. And there are multiple cases where licenses are revoked for breaking and changing your tax-exempt purposes. You can't do that. You're not allowed to do that.
Right.
And you're just not. And the question of, you know, we could take apart each of the points you've made. They were never authorized to fight HIV/AIDS in Africa. There's no evidence in their filings that they actually did that. Their audits, their books and records have never been externally audited, you know, audited properly, as is legally required by a competent accounting firm. Never.
And if I was to take my charity, I mean, let's say that I have a charity that's studying, that's related to hepatitis C, and I want to add HIV/AIDS to it. So I would file with the IRS and say we're modifying our purpose to include this, and the IRS would basically say yes or no?
Yes, but you see, what you're describing is a sort of you have to remember that lawyers are clever people, and the Clintons are clever. They're not honest, but they're clever. And the IRS asks you to choose an uppercase tax-exempt purpose. That's your objective.
Right.
Right, and not all objectives are charitable. They're defined by statute.
Right.
Okay, what is and what is not, and also by case law. But so you have to pick a purpose. What you're describing there is can also be known as an activity. So a purpose is approved And then the activities you undertake in furtherance of your purpose must exclusively further your purpose.
Okay, so if
so
my...
you go out and... Wait, let me just finish. If you go out and you say that you want to fight HIV/AIDS, okay, mm-hmm. and you then decide that a related issue is lung cancer, you probably have to get the IRS to approve that because, you know, people who are expert on HIV/AIDS may or may not be experts on lung cancer.
Right, right. I understand that.
Yeah.
But I guess there is a big question. One of the things that I saw, and I don't know if you had written it, I think you did, but so many, $140 million in grants and pledges since 2013, but only $9 million actually on programs.
I'm not the one who wrote that, but that, it was in Zero Hedge, and they picked up other people's language, but that is... So the issue is that when you look at the 990, which is the annual report for the foundation, and if that was 2013, what you see is a paltry amount of money spent on donations to other foundations inside and outside the U.S.
Right.
for charitable work, and then you see very large expenditures for travel and salaries and this and that. And so the question, the fundamental question is, are the people who are receiving these salaries and spending the money for travel, were they really doing that in furtherance of an authorized tax-exempt purpose? And there has been never an independent check of that. The Board of Trustees of the Clinton Foundation is enthralled to the Clinton family. They are not independent.
Right, okay,
there was never an independent auditing firm. And the financial statements that are submitted as, quote, audits are not legally compliant audits. The fact that you can discern for yourself if you read the rules or by checking with a standard accounting firm will tell you this is BS audits. These are not audits.
Right. In the movie, I think it was Clinton Cash, there was they talked about a Canadian mining executive who ended up with the sole uranium mining rights, I think, was it Kazakhstan or Uzbekistan, one of those countries?
Right. Yeah.
And there was a time when Bill Clinton flew there and met with the president, and then the mining executive had a meeting with the president, and then all of a sudden there's an announcement that he's got exclusive uranium mining rights. Would it have been possible that Bill Clinton was flying on the dime of the Clinton Foundation to get there?
Certainly. Let's take that case for a little bit. So Frank Giustra, I don't really know much about him other than what's in the public domain, but, you know, the report suggests that he began to get involved with the Clintons by 2005. The trip you're talking about was to Almaty, Kazakhstan in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many, many press accounts of this. Both interviews that Giustra did and other press accounts. Then in 2006, Bill Clinton had a series of 60th birthday parties. One was orchestrated in Canada, where there are press accounts that tens of millions of dollars were raised, I think in Toronto.
Yeah.
Then there's a New York Times article by someone called Joe Becker and somebody named Don Van Matta, which suggests that 31 point some odd million were donated by Giustra to the Clinton Foundation. I've checked your Canadian law, or the Canadian laws. I regularly am on Canadian television and radio, and I've become familiar with the Canadian laws. And at that time, a Canadian person could not receive a tax deduction in Canada for donations to a foreign charity, which the Clinton Foundation was, unless the federal government of Canada had made a donation to the Clinton Foundation, and that did not occur until the 2nd of June 2010. Moving along in 2007, the Clinton Giustra, I forget the name of this, Sustainable Growth Partnership or something like that was created. And that was a joint venture between the Clinton Foundation and Giustra that was not legally organized inside the United States of America or Canada. Why? Because an agency agreement by public accounts was entered into between that joint venture, wherein control of the joint venture was passed to the Clinton Foundation, and the Clinton Foundation did not have the legal authority to control that venture. That agency agreement has never been filed publicly in the United States, And the people who were running it, a man called Eric Nonac, N-O-N-A-C-S, who is still associated with it, I think was based in either California or New York. And the fact that the Clinton Foundation was running this joint venture was not properly disclosed. It wasn't disclosed in New York or California, and it needed to be.
Right. Did Joostra get a tax exemption?
I don't. That's a question for your for Canadian authorities. I don't know. I would guess, of course, he did.
It seems a bit strange that, mining. There are mining executives that make a lot of money, and then they decide that as they get older or something that they want to, make the world a better place after they've dug big holes in the ground and polluted rivers. They suddenly decide that they want to support the symphony orchestra or something. But there's sort of a sense that this these donations are kind of tied to Joostra getting mining rights and making even more money.
Right. Well, yeah, it's even more insidious than that, I think. Mm-hmm. The way this kind of stuff works, I suspect, is that, I'm very suspicious of anybody, whether they're on the right or the left, who extols the virtues of, quote, public-private partnership. They think that's baloney.
Right.
I think that government officials are not paid a lot of money anywhere, and they control decisions that have enormous economic consequences.
Right.
They get very used to flying around on the taxpayer dime, living like princes and princesses, in private jets and presidential suites and motorcades and fancy lunches and dinners and this and that.
Yeah, just let me. So in a public-private partnership, the private partner has a private jet, whereas if you're working for the government, I don't think most American bureaucrats get flown around in private jets, right?
You would be sad to learn the answer, and that is there are a lot of private jets that government bureaucrats fly around.
Okay.
But just getting back to this issue, It is quite common up in Vancouver, and I'm not making disparaging comments here about my great neighbor to the north. I have ancestors from Canada. A great country. Vancouver, on the other hand, though, does have a troubled history of having at times a white-hot stock market, then an ice-cold stock market, filled with gamblers who like to speculate on whether a mining play or an oil play or a resource play around the world holds any value.
Mm-hmm.
So when you get together, and Joostra's an expert in this type of stuff, when you marry up a private speculator who can control a shell company with a foreign government leader who can grant a shell company a valuable concession that speculators can speculate is worth a lot of money, you have all the ingredients for securities fraud and charity fraud. So you fly into Kazakhstan, you give the Kazakhstan leader, who's a bit of a tyrant, the international, in theory, seal of good approval from Bill Clinton, that he's actually a good man, he makes nice noises, he's a forward-looking person. So that guy's happy, and he turns around and grants a concession to Joostra that's very valuable. It goes into a shell company. That shell company then is traded on the market. It rockets up in value, and the insiders in that shell company can either sell out or hold on to the shares, depending on their preference. This is a pattern that you see around the world with Joostra. And others close to Lucas Lundin, other people close to the Clintons, appreciate this. Dennis O'Brien,
right.
Rajat Gupta. Sundry people understand that government leaders hold the keys to vast fortunes in these so-called public-private partnerships, and they're very complicated, and the normal person doesn't really follow and connect all the dots.
And Bill Clinton would act as kind of the grease of this whole thing, because he can talk to just about any world
right.
leader. And I think in the case of Kazakhstan, he said some really nice things about a leader who, like you said, is a tyrant.
Right.
Bill Clinton said positive things about his human rights record and things like that.
Right. And, the same thing for Paul Kagame in Rwanda. Look up Paul Kagame and look at what happened when Bill Clinton was president. We can talk about him being, in quotes, the first African-American president. But, when people were slaughtering one another in the hundreds of thousands in Rwanda, the United States sat and did nothing.
Yes.
So we rushed into other countries, and I'm not saying I know whether we should or shouldn't have, but I am saying that anybody who was associated with that mess, and Paul Kagame certainly was, cannot wash his hands even by becoming, you know, Mother Teresa.
Well, I think there was an attempt.
Bill Clinton has, pardon this phrase, whitewashed Paul Kagame. He's made great speeches about it. And understand that Rwanda is close to countries that have gigantic mineral deposits.
Right.
And, you know, it is quite possible that there was a game going on here in Africa, that, you know, the people around Clinton who want these deposits use the cover of charity and use these connections that Clinton can gain and the good opinion that these bloody dictators want to have in the public eye as, you know, sort of a rotten bargain here. There are merchants around misery around the world. They're Robin Hood in reverse. They're stealing money intended for desperate souls,
right,
and enriching people connected to the Clintons, all in the guise of charity.
Right. Now, speaking of, I quoted before, you know, $140 million in grants and $9 million spent on programs, but Charity Watch, which is supposed to be monitoring charities, says that the Clinton Foundation spends 88% of their money on programs. So that seems like a pretty big disconnect.
Well, I'll explain that disconnect
for you. Yeah, could you?
I'm somebody who exposed General Electric as being, you know, engaged in, I think, in fraudulent activity. At the time I exposed GE, they were one of the very few companies in the world that still had a AAA rating, Moody's and S&P.
Right.
Moody's and S&P are gigantic organizations. Publicly traded, Moody's and a subsidiary of a publicly traded McGraw-Hill, in the case of S&P. Gigantic resources,
mm-hmm,
backed by powerful people, filled with staff. Charity Watch is a peanut. It's a million-dollar organization. It raised 8,000 charities. If you divide the amount of money they spend all told on program expenditures, what you were discussing earlier, it's about $1.2 million. You divide that by 8,000 charities they say they watch, that's $150 per charity.
Right.
There's no way they have studied the Clinton Foundation. And, again, Mark Tapscott of the Daily Caller has written an article about this, too. You can see it for yourself, that the Charity Watch leadership, in my view, was bought off by the Clintons. They have participated in joint events. They've been let in for free into the Clinton Global Initiative, which is a fraud, in my view, and I can get to that. That cost $20,000 to get into, and they were let in for free, like other NGOs. But they, you know, they got a lot of public press out of this, and it is certainly possible. One of the oldest questions in actually republics is who regulates the regulator, and you know, Charity Watch, Charity Navigator is the $1.2 million one, and Charity Watch is even smaller. That's a $500,000 total revenue operation. Not equipped to do the kind of work you really need to do here, and people fall for it. And this is also standard Clinton operating procedure. You get some supposedly independent third party with a reputable name to bless you, like
right,
the Benghazi Independence Committee that wasn't independent, or the 9/11 Committee that wasn't truly independent, or you pick it. You get somebody who doesn't have the real evidence but has a name that gullible people will accept as being, you know, credible. And you hide behind that. It's just proof positive, frankly, of more fraudulent activity that they would still be hiding, trying to hide behind Charity Navigator and Charity Watch.
I read another count
in their indictment, in my view.
All right. I looked at some stuff on Charity Watch, and it seemed like their president was paid a pretty big salary every year, but their board of three or four people didn't get any payment, and I wondered if that meant that they were basically just a formality, you know, some friends of the guy to make it
right,
look like there's a real board. Why would a board get no compensation at all?
Well, that's standard for charities, that board members don't take compensation. But what is unusual in Charity Watch and Charity Navigator is how little money is spent on accounting and legal fees year by year. Now, the only way you're going to figure out that an international charity is a lot more complicated than a domestic charity is if you hire a lawyer. If you study it yourself, which is prone to... Now, I got no life, so I'm very happy to... my kids are happily grown and out of the house, and I'm divorced and single, and I'm proud of it. But, you know, I got to figure out something to do, and this is—I like doing this, so I waste my time on it because I think it's important. But you know, the average human doesn't necessarily have the same level of patience and interest, and it takes a while to appreciate the special rules that apply to all public charities,
mm-hmm,
like the Foundation, and then the even tougher restrictions on U.S. public charities that want to operate internationally. And I guarantee you that Charity Watch and Charity Navigator that have spent a pittance on outside legal and accounting fees haven't a clue about these detailed rules.
Do you know how they came up with Charity Watch? I mean, Charity Navigator said that they weren't going to rate the Clinton Foundation. I think they might have recently changed their mind, saying it was just not set up properly. Right. But Charity Watch said, you know, this 88% on programs. I mean, how did they come up with that number when other people are quoting a tiny percentage spent on programs?
Because they're buying the argument that that all of the salaries and all of the travel and everything listed out under the column program service expenses is all legitimate, even though there's never been an audit. So nobody really knows why you would spend so much on travel and conferences and office expenses and all this stuff. There's never been a legally compliant audit. So nobody really knows, but these fools, and I will just say flatly on this podcast, they are fools for many reasons, because they have extreme legal liability here. When people get into this, when the civil lawsuit people start, when the government authorities start looking for people to blame, one of the people they're going to blame here is Charity Watch. Another is Charity Navigator. They did not discharge. Another is PolitiFact, for that matter. They did not do, and the record will clearly show, when you know the tough subpoenas come from the House of Representatives, from the Senate, from the Attorneys General, from people around the world, when the civil litigation starts, and they have to say exactly what work was done producing this rating. Who did it? What's their experience? Show us the time they spent on it. What documents did they look at? How come they didn't look at this? How come they didn't look at that? The standard that will be trotted out is a standard called gross negligence and reckless misconduct. And when you can prove gross negligence and reckless misconduct, you are a magnet for lawsuits. And there are people on both boards, Charity Watch and Charity Navigator, who have money, who are not going to be happy.
Yeah, well, they could have legal responsibility, right, if they're on the board of an organization.
Not could. The operative word is not could.
Yes.
The operative word, see, no, it's serious. In the United States, you have three, as a trustee, I know this because I've studied it and I have lawyers telling me, explain this. You have three duties, paramount duties as a trustee, which must stand above your personal interests. You have a duty of care. That means as a trustee, you can't, you know, say, well, I never really bothered to know the rules. You have to understand the rules and you have to familiarize yourself with the activities of the charity. You can't blame it on the executive director or the finance people or anybody else. You have a duty of obedience, which means that you have to obey all the laws, not just your state law or federal law, all foreign laws as well if you're operating internationally. Then you have a duty of loyalty. What does that mean? That means where a conflict presents itself, and your personal interests are in conflict with the charity's personal interests, you must subordinate your personal interests to the interests of the charity and hold the charity's interests above your own.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like crystal clear things, because, you know, as a trustee of a charity, and this is a lesson to anybody who wants to be a charity, a trustee of a U.S., and indeed, I guess, I would think up in Canada, and I know in England, anywhere where the tradition is based off English law, it has the same basic principles, some shading. You must protect. You stand in the shoes of government as a trustee of a charity. And you must, you know, you cannot engage in any illegal activity.
Can you give some examples? Can you give some examples of where you think that the Clinton Foundation has a big program, you know, Haiti, HIV, AIDS, climate change, where they've actually not been spending money on programs?
Okay, let's start with the biggest one, the Clinton HIV/AIDS initiative, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Total fraud, from soup to nuts. The activity began by Bill Clinton's admission around the 12th of July, 2002. It began again by his admission after 12th July, 2002. They may have organized their first activity in the Bahamas. Now, Americans are not allowed to set up a charity first internationally. You have to set it up in the United States of America, and it must be tightly, if it's going to be tax exempt, it has to be tightly controlled from the U.S. base.
Right.
They nonetheless began this thing in the Bahamas, and they solicited and accepted a lot of money by Bill's own admission in a book called Giving, published September 2007. they solicited it in Canada and in Ireland and in many other foreign countries as early as 2002-03 time frame. And they solicited to fight HIV/AIDS around the world. There's no accounting. The accounting forms on the Clinton Foundation website are not there. They're none.
I
had to do audits for 2002 and 3. There are no audits for 2002 and 3. But they were actually fake audits were procured that are available on the Commonwealth of Massachusetts website. And they state flatly that those accounting statements are presented at the direction of the trustees using principles that are not allowed, accounting principles that are not allowed in the United States of America. Okay? You know, that you can't do. You're not allowed to do that. There are press releases of Bill Clinton claiming that they did this and raised hundreds of millions of dollars around the world. So then by 24 March 2004, they set up something called the Clinton Foundation HIV/AIDS Initiative, Inc. in Arkansas, and they registered to do business from a base, headquarters base in Massachusetts. Well, prior to that date, there's evidence they were operating from Massachusetts. You're not allowed to do that. Violation of state law. And then they fill out, they haven't yet filed what's called a 1023. That's the basic application to form a charity. They haven't published that anywhere for this entity. But we found them, what are called 990s, annual reports for this subsidiary fighting HIV/AIDS for 2004 and 2005. And they are riddled with errors. And they then claim that they have merged this entity under Arkansas law as of December 31st, 2005. It's a claim in the 990s.
Merged
legally, it's not possible. It's not possible. You check Arkansas law and other laws. In order to merge a tax-exempt entity into another entity, the acquirer, the surviving one, has to be authorized in advance by the IRS for the different purpose of the target. And that never happened. The target has to be an authorized tax-exempt entity, which it was not as of that date. There's no evidence produced so far that it was.
I was just going to say that my understanding of one of the supposed big successes of this Clinton HIV/AIDS initiative, whichever legal entity it was that was doing this, was that they negotiated lower prices for drugs in Africa. But that struck me that you wouldn't need to spend $100 million to do that. You might spend $100 million on buying drugs for people, but I mean, was the Clinton Foundation actually buying and distributing drugs, or were they just negotiating with generic drug manufacturers, or does anybody actually know what they were doing?
Well, nobody really knows the answer, which is completely unacceptable. Now, let's go through that a little bit, okay?
Yeah.
Connection does not mean causality. Right? The fact that you're in a room while somebody lowers the price of drugs doesn't mean that you're responsible for lowering the price of drugs.
Right.
And when you look into this in some detail, and I gather you have expertise in medicine and stuff like that, you know a lot more about this than I do. When you look into it, there's a great book called by Lindsay McGooey, L-I-N-S-E-Y, then M-C-G-O-E-Y, called No Such Thing as a Perfect Gift. And it recounts in great detail that when Bill Clinton was president in 1998, a company called Cipla, C-I-P-L-A, an Indian-based manufacturer of generic AIDS medicines and other generic drugs, attempted to break the patent in South Africa and supply generic AIDS medicines in South Africa.
Right.
And the Clinton administration and other governments around the world opposed that. And Lindsay argues, I think possibly incorrectly, that the decision to oppose that mission led to an increase in the percentage of people who suffered from AIDS from 14% of the adult population to 22%. Again, I'm not sure you could prove that.
I would disagree with that, because the drug you're talking about is AZT, which is one of the most toxic poisons in the world. I think what you had was a company called GlaxoSmithKline, formerly Burroughs Wellcome, that was manufacturing a drug that had been developed by the U.S. taxpayer and that had sort of been abandoned, was taken off the shelf by GlaxoSmithKline, became an incredibly expensive drug, fraudulently approved in the United States. And now people like Cipla wanted to be able to sell it for, 10%, 1% of the cost, because it really didn't cost that much to make.
Right. But so my point to you, though, is that the process of, we can debate at another moment, if you want, we can debate the whole HIV/AIDS thing, because I'm not really an expert on that. Just as to the charity piece of it, I think I know what I'm talking about here. What happened was that the price of HIV/AIDS medicines had already been brought down well before Bill Clinton had anything to do, and in spite of Bill Clinton. Okay?
Right.
So to say that they are responsible for bringing the price down, the first issue would be, let's unpack that statement. How can somebody, Bill Clinton, an Ira Magaziner, who are neither officers nor trustees of the Clinton Foundation, claim that even if they did this, the Clinton Foundation brought the price of HIV/AIDS drugs down? They weren't on the, nowhere will you find their names as officers or directors or executives of the Clinton Foundation in 2002, 2003, and 2004. They're not listed.
So if
Bill Clinton wasn't an officer or director of the Clinton Foundation until of the main foundation until 2013 and of Clinton Health Access Initiative until late 2009, Magaziner was a consultant and he was not really affiliated with the main foundation until I want to say 6 or 7. And he also illegally was involved providing private services not adequately disclosed in the 990s to the foundation. So in terms of did the Clinton Foundation bring the price of HIV/AIDS drugs down, maybe what Bill Clinton and Ira were doing, maybe that contributed to bringing it down. But there were a large number of generic HIV/AIDS manufacturers in India and South Africa and elsewhere that all wanted in on the gravy train,
right,
created by large governments, you know, paying for these drugs.
Right.
And to think that they wouldn't be developing and fighting to get their generic AIDS medicine, you know, into the pipeline absent Bill Clinton is rubbish.
Let me just finish.
Okay. Because I want to give you another great thing.
Okay.
And I appreciate it's your show, but I just want to give you another thing for your listeners. Another thing to there's an important legal case, Federated Pharmacy or something like that, where it was held that just because you provide drugs, even at a discount, does not mean that you are engaged in charity. Okay, the act of the question of providing drugs alone, that's not necessarily under our law a charitable activity, right?
Right.
And in order for it to be a charitable activity, first of all, you would have had to be approved in advance for that purpose. Where are the medical doctors under the control of the foundation? Because as you know a lot about medicine. I know a very little and I'm squeamish. so that makes this whole thing tough for me. But
right.
You would know. You know, let's assume you accept the idea that HIV/AIDS is an important contributing factor to AIDS. Let's assume we accept that.
Right.
And let's assume you accept that HIV medicines will prolong your life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What people say is that in order to do this properly, the medicine is 15-25% of the cost. The real issue and beyond that is, you know, the doctor's care, monitoring. There are lots of attendant costs. And it is irresponsible, I would argue even reckless, to be giving people with no medical degrees control using volunteers over a theoretical exercise to get these medicines, which nobody checks, into supposed patients who may or may not actually have HIV, because the tests are not necessarily 100% right.
Right.
Living in the bush in desperately poor countries where there's no electricity, no water, no medicine, no roads, and, you know, not necessarily after-action care to make sure that these chemicals, which and these drugs, which, as you rightly point out, contain toxic ingredients, and that the people being treated here, as happens for other diseases, may have more than one ailment. You know,
right.
It may not simply be that you come into the place with HIV. You may have some other thing which, you know, could kill you faster. And
right.
That by giving this medicine, you may actually be hastening the demise of these people. So when we get to HIV/AIDS, because there has never been a set of independent trustees, because these operations have never been legally organized or operated, because there's never been an audit, a financial audit checking this thing, the truth is that nobody knows.
Well,
what happened with HIV/AIDS?
Right.
Nobody
knows. If the Clinton Foundation had $100 million and they were going to, you know, solve the AIDS problem by giving people drugs, assuming that that's the way to solve it, they presumably would have a big stable of doctors, nurses, et cetera, in order to roll out a program where they can do the appropriate tests on people, decide who should get which drug, look for side effects, you know, treat the side effects, all of that kind of stuff. But did they have an actual program for HIV/AIDS where they were spending this $100 million, or were they just in the business of sitting down and cajoling drug manufacturers to lower their prices a little bit?
Well, it's even worse than that. If you read Elton John, Love is the Cure. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a musician who, you know, has been passionate for many, many decades now. I think 20 years the man has been out there doing a lot to try to, you know, in theory, help.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he recounts in that book the approach that Bill Clinton took. What Bill Clinton did is he pitched his approach in gross violation of the charity law to the pharmaceutical manufacturers as follows. And it's recounted, it's the first person account by Elton John in his book. You know, maybe he's lying, but I don't think he is.
Right, I doubt it.
What he claims Clinton did is he went to the branded pharmaceutical companies first and he said, you guys don't know what you're doing. I, Bill Clinton, do. All right? Mm-hmm. You don't understand that what you're doing by setting the prices so high, you're not appreciating the fact that people who take your medication are lifelong customers. So that if you were to lower your price, you would actually capture a lot more business because these people who are not getting treated are dying, and if you gave them the medicine, they live and they buy your medicine. And then he pitched in the book to Elton John, he pitched the denial by the pharmaceutical companies as evil, you know, that these guys, all they cared about profit, they didn't see the wisdom of his approach.
Okay.
And then he went, which is a diabolical approach, has nothing to do with charity. He was a business development agent for the branded pharmaceutical company. So right. I think correctly looked at this and said, wait a minute, idiot. Okay, the problem in these countries, and Bill Clinton on this point is an idiot. The problem in these countries is not necessarily that the patients don't have testing and medicine, because there is no infrastructure in these countries mm-hmm. to actually treat them. And that it's not that you don't just give somebody a piece of aspirin or something like that, or a vitamin pill, and you cure them of HIV/AIDS. There are side effects that need to be monitored,
right?
As I said earlier, right?
So when it
didn't work for the branded one, he went to the generic one. Now the generic companies back then were peanuts, Ranbaxy
right.
and Aurobindo and Aspen and Matrix and Enchem and these various companies that were trying to do generic versions of these branded drugs. They were all small. Many of them were completely unregulated in their home country. You know, India had a very lax approach towards regulating things like this.
Right.
There were tiny companies who, you know, who were publicly traded in most cases. And, you know, the argument that, as with Injustra, we go back to the shell company approach, you know, here you have George W. Bush in January 28, 2003 saying, I'm going to force Congress or ask Congress to give $15 billion of real cash money, you know, into the pipeline to buy these drugs. And these Indian and South African generic companies say, holy baloney, I mean, this is a great pipeline. So what I think the HIV/AIDS operation was not a charity at all. And indeed, there's an article published by The Atlantic magazine entitled, This Is Not Charity, where Ira Magaziner uses that expression. It says, what I'm doing is not charity. Well, how come he wasn't prosecuted? Because you're not allowed to do this.
Yeah.
Because it is charity.
A couple of things.
But he admits it.
Yes. A couple of things. There was a time when the big thing in AIDS was getting a drug to be $1 a day. And this was seen as, you know, making things really affordable. But when I actually read the label of the drug that they were promoting for $1 a day, and I don't know if Clinton had anything to do with this, among other things, it said that you had to have regular liver monitoring because liver failure
right.
was a side effect.
Right.
Plus, women had to use two forms of birth control because it wasn't safe during pregnancy. And I'm thinking, you know,
right.
if you live in a poor part of Africa, you probably can't
right.
afford birth control at all, let alone two forms. And who's going to do the liver monitoring? And what if you have liver failure caused by this drug? Who's going to give you the liver transplant? Well, no, you're going to die. Right. That's
well, and look up that. Look that up. You know, look up what really happened. I believe you know more than I do about this, but maybe your listeners know. I mean, look up what happened in South Africa. I mean, the other thing you can't do when you take this medicine is drink alcohol.
Really?
And you know, who checked to make sure these people weren't drinking?
Well,
you know, and a further thing you can't do is you're not doing somebody a favor, hooking them up to HIV/AIDS medicine. And paying for it for 1 year if they might live another 15. And where are they going to come up with the next 14 years of medical costs?
Right. We only have a few minutes left. One thing I wanted to talk about, I don't know if you know a lot about this, but at the time when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, she was not accepting money for speaking engagements, I presume, at that time, but her husband, Bill Clinton, was. Plus, there was money coming into the Clinton Foundation. I mean, have you seen any connections between who was donating to the Clinton Foundation, who was paying Bill Clinton for speeches, and who was getting, arms deals approved by the Secretary of State?
I've focused less on arms deals and a lot more on education, on laureate education, because that's an easy case.
Okay.
So laureate is a string. I would argue it's a Ponzi scheme. It's a for-profit string of supposed universities around the world. And if we think about that for a second, you know, most places in the world, there are government-supported, high-quality educational institutions, and there are also good private institutions, none
right.
of which is engaged in the business of trying to make a profit for its investors.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the notion that you could compete, you could set up a heavily indebted system. Laureate has over $4 billion of stated debt, backed by greedy capitalists, and I'm a greedy capitalist, so,
right.
you know, but I wouldn't do this.
Right.
You know, with no morals, and induce people to take subprime loans to go to a subprime institution where there's little chance in this world, as machines are replacing people everywhere, you know, actually benefiting. To take out these expensive loans, which I don't think you can discharge in bankruptcy, is an irresponsible thing to do.
Right.
And, you know, even more so, when the former president of the United States is trotted out as his good housekeeping seal of approval as part-time chancellor of this thing, and nowhere in the Clinton Foundation forms does it disclose that he and Hillary pulled down $17.6 million from 2010, dollars, U.S. dollars, between 2010 and 2015 for that work. That's directly from Laureate. Nobody in Laureate made that much in annual compensation. You could go on and on about that. But then in addition, the financiers and the lenders to Laureate also separately paid the Clintons lots of money, millions of dollars of speaking fees.
But did they get any benefits from the Secretary of State?
Well, yeah. The Secretary of State included Doug Becker, in CEO of Laureate, in meetings with other, you know, real universities, gusting its image up around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the real one. The Secretary of State of the United States has a lot of influence, indirect influence, over the World Bank and over the IFC, which are separate institutions, heavily backed by U.S. taxpayer money and your government, another
right.
government, a Canadian government, and others, right?
Mm-hmm.
The IFC in 2013, you know, remember, Bill's getting, Hillary's getting $17.6 million. Hillary's still the Secretary of State. On her way out the door, the IFC approved a $100 million investment in the riskiest securities of Laureate. $100 million from them directly, $50 million from a fund backed, managed by the IFC, and $50 million by the Korean Investment Corporation, at a time after which Laureate had failed to complete a public offering to reward its investors. You know, the deal for Laureate came together in August of 2007. They tried to take the thing public at a high value to make investors believe they'd had a good return. They failed. They needed to have an argument that Laureate was still a winner, so they get rescue capital out of the IFC. That's an open and shut case, as far as I'm concerned, of, you know, where investigators should be seizing on this.
Right.
Indeed, the House of Representatives, led by Marsha Blackburn and others, is looking hard at this, and I hope people are going to take a hard look at Laureate.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a lot more, I think there's still a lot more, many more nooks and crannies that need to be investigated, because it seems to be a very opaque institution. There's a lot more that we could talk about, but we're kind of running out of time for my show. And I'd just
Good.
Like to thank you for giving me some of your time. And I believe you have a website, charlesortel.com.
Yeah, that's the website. And I'm on Twitter at charlesortel, uppercase C, uppercase O. I try to respond to people to the extent possible.
Okay.
And I really appreciate, David, your reaching out to me and the work you do, and thanks for letting me come on your show.
Yeah, thank you. It's been great talking to you today. Goodbye.
All of it.
In the upcoming election, Americans are faced with a false dichotomy. If you're a so-called progressive, you look at Trump and see an ignorant, misogynist, racist, and probably a few other nasty words too. And you'd be right. But that doesn't prove that Hillary is a good choice. And people on the right look at Hillary and see a warmonger who lied about her use of email to share state secrets, who didn't do enough in Benghazi, and who has been dishonest about her positions in the past, especially those with her husband Bill Clinton. And they'd be right, too, but that doesn't prove that Donald Trump is a good choice. And your other choices are Gary Johnson, the libertarian, who doesn't seem to know about Aleppo, which just is incredible, and Jill Stein, who, to be honest, would be my choice if I was an American. But she's not perfect either. She's beholden to the global warming establishment that has diverted the attention of environmentalists from real environmental issues, such as toxic pollution in our air, in our water, in our food. And she's also not brave enough to really criticize vaccines, although to give her credit, she made a mild criticism which earned her widespread, extreme scorn from so-called progressives who appear to believe that all vaccines are 100% safe and effective, which is clearly not true even if you just read the labels on the vaccines, which of course nobody does. Trump is correct. The system is rigged. And the winner will certainly not be the best choice for America because it will either be Trump or Clinton. Maybe it's lucky that the president is really just a pawn. Even a man with beautiful rhetoric, like Obama, ends up doing what he's told. He's just a spokesperson for the institution of government. Someone who, with a straight face, can talk about a judicial process for his assassination list when presidents used to deny that they ever had a list like this, even though everybody knew that they did. It's now talked about openly, but the whole concept of a judicial process when there is none is a farce. There was some concern recently that Russian hackers could manipulate U.S. elections. I think this is laughable because the big threat is the insider threat. With federal elections managed by partisan county and state officials, there can be no true integrity. It's not that elections might be rigged, they have been for years. An article on a website called The Conversation, which was republished in Newsweek, points this out, saying, "We don't know that most citizens will cast their ballots on electronic voting machines. In 43 states, those machines are more than a decade old. These are the computers that were introduced immediately after the Bush-Gore election in 2000 to correct the problems with that election that had cast doubt on the actual choices of many Florida voters." And I should point out, a little segue here, that it's the Electoral College here that was the problem, because the whole election came down to Florida, and everybody else's votes were being ignored. Continuing, over the last decade or so, it's been conclusively demonstrated that at least some models of electronic voting machines are vulnerable to hacking by people with the skills of graduate students in computer science. No one knows how secure the other machines are because many vendors have asserted their intellectual property rights to prevent the security of their machines from being examined by independent parties. If hacked, an electronic voting machine cannot be trusted to count votes accurately. In an election conducted with paper ballots, the ballots themselves can be recounted, but with many electronic voting machines, there's no record of the votes cast other than the digital information contained in the machine itself. The idea of recounting electronically cast votes is therefore meaningless. But then the article makes an absurd segue. Considering the problems with election machines and election vote counting and potential Russian hackers, they say, "The much more likely threat to democracy is sore losers who cast doubt on the integrity of the voting process. The political stability of the United States over the past 240 years is due in part to the willingness of election losers to concede a victory to election winners. To be sure, close elections like Bush-Gore in 2000 have resulted in disputes, but in the end, courts and legislatures found ways to declare victors, and the losers have accepted those declarations even if they have disagreed with them. The same cannot be said of elections in other countries. Generally, there is no right of recount when the margins of victory are large. The reason is that large-scale vote fraud or miscounts are assumed to be much less likely than their small-scale counterparts. But when computers are involved in vote counting, much of the public, especially those supporting the losing candidate, may not be willing to make that assumption." So what the author is basically saying in a rather tortuous way is that Trump will probably lose the current election, although I'm not quite so confident about that given the recent polls. And he'd better damn well not claim that the system is rigged, even though we know that it is, because despite that fact, that the entire system is vulnerable to manipulation, the author is basically saying, well, it couldn't manipulate the entire country, which kind of contradicts what he told us just a few paragraphs ago. I think a bigger question for Americans is not who's going to win this election, but how to make massive and radical changes to the election system so that it truly reflects the will of the people. An article on TechTarget.com noted that the FBI had warned that several state voter registration systems had been hacked, and they said they didn't think any data had been stolen, but how would they possibly know? This is actually not, in a sense, not too big of a problem, because you can publicly purchase this data, and there's a lot of election-related software that does, and it gets the names and addresses of everybody in the database. But they used an attack called SQL injection that can just as easily be used to change the data in the voter registration system. And of course, if the data in the voter registration system can be changed, then records could be deleted that appeared to have names of a particular ethnic group or that lived in particular areas, or information could be changed such that when those people went to vote, they would be told that they'd registered to vote for mail and they couldn't vote in person or whatever. So a lot of mischief could be done with this kind of a system, and it might not be obvious unless the voter registration system has a lot of checks in place to see whether things have been modified in an unauthorized fashion, or whether their database software even allows this to be done. It might not be until the election, when people show up and can't vote, that they realize that something big has happened to their voter database. This is clearly a problem in any jurisdiction. Canada, England, anywhere has to maintain a voter registration database, whether it uses a system like the US system or not. However, in many jurisdictions, it's possible to vote even if you're not in the registration system, if you provide proof of address, or if you have somebody vouch for you, or something like that. But in the United States, this is generally not true, so that if you show up in the polls and the data in the registration database has been modified, it can prevent you from exercising your right as an American citizen to vote. Anyway, I hope by exposing some of this information, change will occur. Thank you for listening to episode 115 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter @infectiousmyth. Until next week, goodbye.